with natural history, it's a world we don't understand as well. You know, it's whenever we make a film, a nature film, we're describing a world, a context that the audience doesn't know intuitively like it does the human world. It's right. harder, it's the harder entry point. And so finding ways of making it relatable, for making it you know, emotionally engaging to help the audience connect and care with the characters, these things are really important.
I think a lot of us, when we're growing up, will have a moment where you went to the woods or a park and you suddenly get that sense of nature being powerful and emotional for us. I'd love to reconnect people back to that.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I'm a documentary filmmaker, cinematographer, and National Geographic Explorer based in the San Francisco Bay Area. And on this show, I interview the world's best documentary filmmakers about how they craft the stories they tell. We have a great show for you today, as I'm joined by executive producer James Honeyborn and series producer Sophie Todd for a deep dive into the making of their new Netflix series, Our Great National Parks. Our Great National Parks is a stunning five-part series executive produced and narrated by President Barack Obama, who protected more public lands and water than any other U.S. president in history. The series invites viewers to experience nature in the world's most iconic national parks. Spanning five continents, the series brims with wonder, humor, and optimism as each episode tells the story of a national park through the lives of its wildest residents, both big and exceptionally small, and explores our changing relationship with wilderness. Our Great National Parks beckons us to get out and explore, create new ways for these wild places to thrive, and vigorously preserve them for future generations to come. Before we jump into the conversation, a little bit more about our guests. First, we have executive producer James Honeyborn. James is a wildlife filmmaker with a mission to create entertaining and impactful viewing experiences for everyone who seeks to experience, enjoy, and connect with the natural world. Whilst based at the world-renowned BBC Natural History Unit, his work included Sir David Attenborough's hit series Africa, Emmy-nominated Wild New Zealand, and BAFTA-winning Big Blue Live. His latest blockbuster, the multi-award-winning Blue Planet 2, broke BBC's record as the most watched wildlife documentary series in over 20 years. After 25 years of public service broadcasting, in 2018, James set up his own production company, Freeborn Media, making films and TV series in creative partnership with Netflix. Freeborn also makes some social-led campaigns aiming to create lasting impact around issues of wildlife, nature, and the environment. Next, we have series producer Sophie Todd. Sophie is an award-winning filmmaker renowned for imbuing projects with visual style and compelling narratives. She thrives on creating original films that push the boundaries of conventional storytelling. She's worked on everything from high-end natural history films to science and observational documentary, most recently writing, directing, and series producing on Netflix's Formula One, Drive to Survive. She's committed to developing new and diverse talent within the industry and also attracts some of the world's most creative filmmakers to work with her. In this conversation, James, Sophie, and I discuss the vast amounts of research, planning, and scripting that went into this series, how they managed a global production team during the peak of the pandemic, and why natural history documentaries are so important when it comes to illustrating how interconnected we all are with the natural world and the animals that surround us. So let's hit that trailer to get us in the mood, and then I hope you enjoy my conversation with James Honeyborn and Sophie Todd.
A fish that can walk. Surfing hippos want to catch the waves. Species found nowhere else on Earth. Join me in this celebration of our planet's greatest national parks and wilderness. Around the world, the more isolated the national park, the more unusual its creatures, and the more extraordinary their behaviors. When humanity started to protect these wild places, we did not realize how important they would become. They're a haven for endangered species and a hotbed for scientific research. This sloth has an entire microkingdom living in his fur. Researching him will help fight cancer, malaria, and antibiotic-resistant superbugs. This sleepy sloth might just save us all. But this is a journey through the natural wonders of our shared birthright.
James Honeyborn, Sophie Todd, welcome to the show. Together, your new 5-part documentary series is out today on Netflix. It's titled Our Great National Parks. So first, I want to say congratulations on this massive accomplishment. And for either of you who wants to lead off the conversation today, just curious how it feels to have something that you've been working on for this many years finally be coming out to the world.
It feels amazing. Yeah, it's incredible. It's been 3 years in production, and I'm just so excited to share it with everyone, really.
Yeah, wildlife documentaries, they take a long time to make. You know, you can't rush it. So, it's been a 3-year journey for us.
So, speaking of wildlife documentaries, natural history, or just documentary storytelling in general, I'd love to learn a little bit about each of your backgrounds and how you developed a love for this craft. So maybe why don't we begin with Sophie? How did you get into this industry?
I was always passionate about storytelling, and I came in from a current affairs background. So initially I began working for people like John Pilger and working on BBC's Panorama and This World, telling stories around the world for people who generally didn't get a chance to have their voices heard. And then throughout my career, I moved more into science and then some natural history filmmaking. And then when I first worked with Netflix, I wrote and directed and series produced the first season of Drive to Survive, which is a show on Netflix as well. And I think for me, I love doing different subjects, different textures, different contexts. It just keeps me so excited as a filmmaker. And so I was talking to Netflix about what next, and they told me about they were setting up a company with James, and the rest is history, basically. I mean, James is the expert in this field.
I was a biologist by degree, and at the end of that, I was either going to go do my doctorate or get into documentary, and I got the bug and got into documentary. I worked at the BBC Natural History Unit in Bristol, that's where I started. And I started in the archives. My first job title was the clerk of the film vaults.
Oh, very prestigious.
Kind of like something out of Harry Potter now, I think.
But
back in the day, the clerk of the film vaults. And I've worked my way up every sort of rung in the production ladder since. I did 25 years at the BBC. I ended as an executive producer, where I oversaw creation and delivery of Blue Planet 2. In my time, I produced a range of films with Sir David Attenborough. I've been lucky enough to work with the great man on many projects.
Yes.
And after Blue Planet, after 25 years of public service, it felt right to do something different. And it's really exciting to be working with Netflix for me, because we get the chance to reach new audiences, and maybe audiences who weren't brought up on a broadcast like the BBC, where there was so much natural history. And so I think there's a real opportunity on a global platform to get new audiences excited about nature. And there's no better time for it than now.
Yeah. With the BBC Natural History team, is it common that a lot of people will come from having a background in biology or, you know, some scientific background that transition into telling stories about the natural world?
Yeah, well, they're either going to come in from the TV route or they're going to come in from the expedition science route, really. And then often people develop skills, so they become really expert at making films up trees or up mountains or underwater. So, you know, you'll find there are different sort of experts. There are lots of marine biologists when we're making Blue Planet, for example. Mm. Or Arctic polar specialists when we're doing Frozen Planet or whatever it is. It's a very, they call it specialist factual, and I think it's well described.
And with those specialists, are those typically on the side of the cinematographers or the people in the field, whereas the producers and maybe the team doing research are those who will work on films that are about natural history, but then they'll also work on, you know, Formula One films and things like that?
The natural history genre tends to sort of stick to itself, and the researchers might have expertise in certain areas, you know, for certain subject areas, or they might be more generalist. There's a whole range, really. And it's the same in our company now. We have a company, Wild Space Productions, and we're partners with my company, Freeborn Media, and with Netflix, and we are creating, you know, a whole range of natural history content.
Yeah. And Sophie, so you mentioned coming from the Formula One series. I'm curious, for you, working on a series outside of the natural history genre, bringing that experience into this series, what are some of the skill sets or the mindset that you had going from like director to series producer that helped you be successful in this effort?
I think Drive to Survive was about trying to share the sport of Formula One in a new and different way. I think a lot of sporting documentaries can be very detail focused, and they're only for the people who are already obsessed in that area. And as a filmmaker, what I like to do is to tell the story in a more accessible way and find new ways of telling stories that might have been told before, or we might know a little bit about them, but to make them more accessible, to make them more engaging if we can. But also there's so many parallels, actually, because if you think about it, the characters in Drive to Survive, it's about what are the stakes, it's about survival on one level or another. And so there's a lot of parallels in terms of those techniques that we use in order to get people to engage with something and understand a different world. And as James says, the wonderful thing with Netflix is you're dealing with an audience who may not necessarily be as familiar with nature films. So we've got a chance to not just sing at the choir, we can really reach a new audience and engage them in a way that maybe they haven't engaged before.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Can I just say one of the things that drew me to
jump
to
in, jump work? In.
One of the things that drew me to Sophie's work was exactly that. It was that sense that, you made me really interested in Formula One, and I wasn't before. And it was just good storytelling. It was good character development, and there were great, you know, great episodes that were very rewarding for any viewer to watch. And I think, you know, if someone can make a subject that's not normally on their kind of radar interesting, then it's a really good sign that because with natural history, it's a world we don't understand as well. You know, it's whenever we make a film, a nature film, we're describing a world, a context that the audience doesn't know intuitively like it does the human world. It's the harder entry point. And so finding ways of making it relatable, for making it you know, emotionally engaging to help the audience connect and care with the characters, these things are really important.
And it seems like so much of that work has to be done in that first episode, in probably the first, you know, 15, 20 minutes to really hook people. So before we get into the actual kind of process of this series, I'm curious, just as strategies for filmmakers out there listening, Sophie, what are some of those things that you have in your mind as a director, producer, going into a series, trying to get people to connect with a subject matter that they might not otherwise know too much about? You mentioned stakes. What are some of the other things that you think about? Oh, we really need to drive this home as quickly as possible so people understand why they should have investment in whatever the documentary is about.
Yeah, I think as a filmmaker, you have to have a few sentences in your heart from the very beginning, which is, this is what this series is about, and this is why I should care about it. And if you haven't got those, you're not going to find them halfway through, or you might get lucky, but you need to begin, come from that understanding at the beginning and then carry it through everything that you do. And of course, these things evolve as you go through the process, but having that sense of connection to nature and why it matters. And, you know, we wanted to make something that was forward facing and of the moment, didn't we? And also to be optimistic as well, in a way that, you know, not to deny the reality of some of the challenges that that nature faces, but to celebrate this idea of national parks. It's 150 years this year since Yellowstone was created, and it's an incredible thing. Humans did a good thing in the natural world, and it's quite nice. Right. Right, we're going to champion that, but also use it as a vehicle to tell people about some positive things that are being done and could be done elsewhere, to drive that message home.
Absolutely, yeah. Go for it, James. Do you have something there?
No, I was going to back that up, but also say, you know, the first thing we do is we've got to decide on what parks we're going to choose on a series mm-hmm. like this. And when you've got over 4,000 of them around the world, you know, 150 years ago, it was a great American idea, but everyone else has taken up on it now. And there's an awful lot of parks to choose from. And we had to choose parks, you know, that would resonate and feel different, because we want each to have its own real story to tell, and to have a theme and a message that relates to the bigger picture, which is really about our relationship with wilderness and why that's so important today. And so we do a lot of thinking at the beginning, a lot of research about the possibilities, and really try and come up with, you know, full written scripts, running orders and scripts that work on paper, that give us that sense of what we might get. We know the animals will never read them. They will do their own thing.
They don't always.
But we write them anyway, and we even draw out storyboards. And the reason we do that, we do that because we need to articulate our ambition to everyone we're working with on location, and to the, obviously to the camera teams particularly. But we and even if the story changes once we're there, it's that kind of shared ambition. It's that sort of leveler and us all getting on the same page, literally. So we always do that. So there's a vast amount of research and preparation, and of course we're also trying to tell new stories that are new science, that are about new species, new behaviors, new places. We want to create novelty and surprise in the stories we tell. So all that takes a lot of research effort and time to craft those scripts and to really work out how we're going to try and tackle those stories and capture those amazing behaviors.
Wow. Okay, I'm fascinated by this. So, all right, just some quick facts for the listeners here. So the series was filmed over the course of 3 years from conception to completion. Production mounted 33 expeditions to 10 countries across 5 continents. They spent over 1,500 days filming wild places in often remote and difficult terrain. I mean, this is a massive undertaking. So, James, you just started to touch on the development process. I mean, the first question that comes to mind as I'm watching this, as a filmmaker who's trying to like direct my first feature right now and try to figure out the process, is like, what is even the first step? Like, you come up with the idea, you come up with the concept. I mean, the team is so massive. What is the first step to make something like this get off the ground and go from idea to a reality?
Find a great series producer. we've got to work out, you know, where are the places we might go to and what are the stories we might tell. And as I said, that takes a long time. Just to go back on your previous stats, though, your brackets at the end should have been in a pandemic, because we were only 2 sequences into filming when we had a global lockdown. And that kind of changed everything. But that's another story. We'll get onto that. That's really interesting, because it's about working with local crews and empowering local talent to do really great work. But back to your point, Yeah, it's about research. It's about really thinking about what your overall story is, what your narrative is, not just across each episode, but across the series. And what is that take home? How are we going to hook people in at the beginning? It's all the classic kind of storytelling structural questions that we'll ask ourselves, because we really want these episodes to engage people and help people connect and care. Because if we can get people ultimately to connect and care on an emotional level, then maybe they'll even be moved towards making meaningful change. And at the far end of this series would be the hope that maybe people will reappraise their own relationship with the natural world and with wilderness, they'll be reminded by just how important wilderness is, and that might even lead to people changing behaviors.
And we started at the beginning in terms of, it was just James and myself and a couple of researchers for a good few, maybe 5-6 months, just starting to talk through the key planks of the series, and then gradually we brought people on as we'd worked out each of the films. So it grew organically, and also it was James's company was very new, so we were the first. Five of us originally. And now, how many have you got now? Hundreds. It's changed a lot since the 3 years.
Wow! Congratulations. That's amazing. What kind of specificity do these scripts and storyboards take? Like, what kind of form are they in? Are you kind of going through episode by episode? Here's kind of the title. This is the animal we want to see. This is the behavior. Are you writing like script transitions between one animal to, the next location? Like, pretty specific?
We do. And we began with a sort of overall grid, though, didn't we? A thematic grid of what does each story tell us in the bigger picture. And then we had these storyboards so running orders first, didn't we, for each episode, so which are the sequences. And then once you've gone distilled that and everybody was happy with those, in have put each 5 films next to each other to make sure we're not telling the same story twice in different places. And then you take on to the next stage, which is, as you say, putting in those transitions, talking about the specificity of the science, of the behaviors, of the camera filming, everything. Right.
And then you end up with a storyboard which looks like a feature or a commercial storyboard. That level of detail, because again, it's how you film these things. About a decade ago, I made a series that was just, it was called Africa. It was with Sir David Attenborough. And when we were making it, I remember a colleague saying, haven't we seen it all before? Mm. And to me, we hadn't even really immersed ourselves in that world. And one of the simple tricks we did back then was just to take the cameras off the sticks, off the tripods, off the filming doors of the Land Rovers, and always meet every animal we met on its eye line in its world. And the effect that had across that series was just immersion. And it just broke that sort of barrier between, oh, look, over there, there's a wildebeest doing something, and come with us into the world of these animals. And it's just a fundamentally different thing, just by thinking about where you place the camera, and what relationship, how you look an animal in the eye. Right. So, we applied that underwater with Blue Planet as well. But it helps the emotional connection. And so every level of detail really is really important. And then there's the technology.
Yeah. So what would be the analogous example from this series as you're thinking about how we going to capture this from a camera or stylistic standpoint in a way that makes it feel different and unique? What were some of the early conversations about that like?
It was all about sense of place, because parks are characters of themselves in this series. We wanted to have multidisciplinary approach to telling that, to getting that across to the viewers. So that's sound and some of the shots that we opted to use, anything from a drop of rain hitting onto a leaf right the way up to the big vistas, so that you can actually feel and experience those places. But we carried that through into the post design. We didn't want to have wall-to-wall commentary and music. I think that some places you never just hear where you are. You don't have time, just be. And we crafted that into the design from the very beginning, didn't we?
That's really interesting. Yeah, and that sense of scale you know, it's communicated in so many ways, not only from like the score of like the big, you know, musical score to silence, but also the scale of the animals, from animals that are super small to ones that are massive, to the scale of, you know, little flowers to, you know, the massive vistas of Patagonia. Like, I thought you all did a really nice job expressing the scale of these places and the nature that inhabits them as well. So you mentioned, James, you started to get into the fact that this was filmed during a global pandemic. I'm wondering if you could take us all to the moment when this whole production had to pivot and change, and where you went from there, two sequences in.
Yeah, we took a deep breath, didn't we? Yeah. We'd filmed the surfing hippos, we'd filmed the Chafaka lemurs in Madagascar, and then it was like, whoa, can we even continue? We found ways, and I think what really stood us in good stead was that we had already had the ambition to work with local crews, rather than sending out people from the UK or the US, because we wanted, firstly, that authentic sense of local voice to be present, yeah, filmmaking, and also because, you know, we're always aware of the carbon costs of these things and air miles and everything. So we where possible, we really wanted to work with local crews anyway, and had good contacts and local camera talent in a number of our locations, and so when the pandemic hit, it was more a case of, well, guys, will you do more? Can you step up? Can you direct this? You know, we'll do what we can from the UK. Sophie still did the really big directing pieces with the president, but really I felt my job was to stay put and to make sure that everyone felt supported, because we were now stretched quite thin. We didn't have the people where we would expect them to be necessary, and it was great how inventive it became. We had one team, they wanted to film in Indonesia in this really hard rainforest that is Gunung Loso National Park, a hard place to work. And they wanted to film this giant flower that grows up to about the height of a basketball hoop. And it lives, the plant lives for 10 years, but the flower lasts 2 days. So it's a huge logistical challenge to find a bud that's going to grow into the flower and the timing right on that. Back in the basement offices in Bristol, we built a half-life size version of the flower out of papier-mâché, painted it up, got it looking good, and then did camera moves around it on phones, stuff like that.
And edited it all together, sent that out to the field, to the team.
No so
that
way.
They could see. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we were so lucky in those... with the tech now, if there's decent Wi-Fi somewhere, then we could look at rushes. We had people directing remotely, having team meetings all on Zoom. I mean, it's not a perfect way of working, but we found we could do so much more than maybe I thought we would be able to achieve at the beginning. It was definitely the moment where everything came into focus, wasn't it? But it was really good. It was a really good practice.
Yeah, I mean, because one of the elements of a natural history series that I feel like audiences come to expect is a very cohesive visual language and style. And employing so many teams across the world, I imagine that would be one of those big challenges, is like, how do we make sure everyone is like, has the same style, the same equipment, all that kind of stuff.
I wrote a style bible for the guys at the beginning. So it's one of the things that we wrote, even as we were fleshing out the details of the details of the series, was to write a style bible, which sets out what our look would be. So that, just because you're exactly right, that problem is how do you communicate to everybody? And it has a mixture of drawings in it and also photographs to help guide people, and talks about stage entrances. How do you introduce your character? How do you have a variety of stage entrances so that we're not going to each story in the same way? So it comes up with lots of different options and gives everybody a palette to choose from. And then we just make sure that all of those are communicated within the team. So that constant, okay, so what did you get? How did this work? How do you think that bit's going to start? Was key to making it feel that you're not seeing the same story again and again, visually or editorially.
Sophie, do you have any fun stories of communication with teams in the field? Either, you know, maybe a team that went in search of an animal and they're just like, Sophie, we've been out here for weeks, we got nothing. Or maybe the moment when something unexpected happened and they're like, we got it, and how good that feels.
We were having a field chat on WhatsApp with the Chilean crew, and they'd been looking for a cod, which you very, very rarely see. It's the smallest cat of the Americas. And as we were talking, one of them suddenly started screaming, and one had walked into the back of their camp as they camped in the park, on the edge of the park, suddenly appeared, and I was suddenly talking to nobody. and they got this, there's a shot of, you see it here in the program. So that was a pretty special moment.
I believe never filmed in the wild before. I mean, incredibly rare to see, let alone capture.
Not that I know.
And it walks into the filming set.
So, yeah.
Filming camp. So, you know, it's amazing how wildlife can sometimes play ball.
Yeah, so for you too, it sounds like during production, working with all those local crews all over the world, you're kind of like mission control center, right? You're getting all the voices from in the field, what's going right, what's going wrong, and kind of adjusting on the fly. Does that kind of characterize how you'd see your role, or what else is in there in terms of like, what is a producer's role, you know, making sure this all comes together?
I think the episode producers, once we'd established the series between us and how each episode would work and the themes, then as the producers became more involved in the detail, they would then take over running their individual films on the day-to-day. And yeah, mm-hmm. we would be mission control, making sure that where things shifted, that everything would be still pulling in the same direction without getting repetitive. You know, it's very easy if that communication breaks down for it to stop feeling part of a cohesive whole. And when you're working on a series like that, it's like this one, it has to hold together. So that, I guess, was the most biggest part. And also the deciding on the tone and the feel of each of the films is quite important too. You know, we didn't want to do something that felt like another series that had been seen before. We were trying to reflect that we're working with the president. He has a different voice. He has his own authority coming from having protected more natural space than any other president in US history. So he has a profound personal connection. And also to having been connected to some of the places that we included in the series.
So speaking of President Obama, at what point did he get involved in the process? Because he does have a personal connection to all the parks that he talks about. And you do feel that as you watch that, okay, this is something that he cares about. He shares stories of, you know, taking his family to these places or growing up on, you know, in Hawaii. And so it feels like he was involved a good amount, but I also know he's a pretty busy guy. So how do you navigate the push and pull of asking the president for his time?
Well, we work with High Ground on the development of the idea and really from, you know, conception through to completion. So we've had good dialogue all the way through. And as you know, when you start thinking about which of the 4,000 parks do you choose, and they're all iconic and stunning and amazing in many, many ways. It really helped to try and isolate ones or suggest ones where maybe the president had a personal connection.
Although he did surprise me, I didn't know that he and Michelle had gone through Monterey on their honeymoon and they saw a whale breach. They stopped and saw a whale and they thought that was a good sign. So there were still some surprises to be had. But I'd read pretty much everything he'd written about national parks or nature or to his autobiographies. But it was definitely, so we put some of those elements in, but he came back with lots of connections that we didn't know about. And that really helped. And also I mean, he took the mickey out of us quite a lot for some of our English expressions in the scripts. And I wouldn't say that. And he added his own flavor, you know, with things like Hang Ten when we were with the surfing hippos.
Yeah.
He brought his own magic to it. So, it's very much a collaborative process.
Yeah,
I imagine. I've heard stories of him from when he was president in terms of writing speeches. A lot of times when he would work with speechwriters, like, he was pretty hands-on with writing some of his most important speeches. And so my guess was that, you know, he did have his hands on some of these scripts and was tailoring them to make them feel as personal as possible. So what was that experience like directing President Obama when you were getting him to do those stand-ups and speak to camera, Sophie? And did that happen during the pandemic, or like that the peak of it? Was that when that happened?
It was Hawaii shoot was fairly early on in the pandemic, really. I think it was the lockdown began in April, wasn't it? It was in December of that year. So we were working with a lot of Hawaiian local crew, again, to minimize travel. But the few of us that came from the UK had to spend 5 days in a hotel room being tested every day before we were allowed out. Mm. That's perfectly understood. It was good prep time. You had more prep time than you would normally have because you couldn't get out of the hotel room. So it really helped to distill everything down. And we did a run through the day before, but actually I'm a pretty relaxed director. I'm very comfortable working with anyone. But in the moment when he got out of the car and walked towards me, it was the first time I'd actually met him in person. And I'll confess, my tummy did do a bit of a loop. I was suddenly, oh my God, this is actually going to happen now. But he's very easy to work with. And he's obviously very used to cameras. It was just that. And he's very relaxed in Hawaii. It's one of his favorite places to be. And he was talking about something he feels very passionate about. So it wasn't a tough directing gig, I have to say.
Yeah, that's great. I also want to touch on the post-production process, and specifically around like pulling scenes together. But I'm also always fascinated about sound design when it comes to these series. And I'm sure there's probably some sound recordists in the field, but I'm always just like curious about that post-production process, especially with natural history. Were these edited back in Bristol, and how involved were you both when it came to the post-production process, and any particular stories that were interesting there that you think might add some value to filmmakers out there?
Natural history, I mean, you know this better than I do, James, correct me if I'm wrong, but natural history people tend to not record sound as much in the field, maybe. And so we...
Depends on the lens. So if you're filming really long lens, you probably can't have a close-up mic next to the animal.
Right.
Because it would be unsafe or unethical because you'd change the animal's behavior. But we often have cameras running. So all the remote cameras, they'll have their microphones running. If nothing else, because they provide really good guide track for us for when we do the final track play. And we do pick up some amazing sounds on them, like we did with the underwater hippos. Mm-hmm. So that's you know, you get these really surprising moments of sound. And obviously, anything that's done that's more sort of about a sound subject, like for example the singing leopard seals.
I was just going to mention that one. Yeah, like such a fascinating sound, like delightful.
Yeah, extraordinary. And we really didn't know they did that. So having directional microphones that allow us to capture that sort of sound, that it's obviously authentic, but B, it's you can't get that anywhere else. You have to record the sound. So I always encourage crews to record sound wherever possible. Mm-hmm. The time where you have a challenge is when you're filming at the end of a long lens, something's happening 300 meters away, there's a wind blowing and you can't hear what's going on. And then that's where the track lay comes in, and that's where we have sound support to help it all sort of glue together and make cinematic sense.
But we also sent guys out with specifically with Zoom recorders and other sound devices so that they could get the sound of the parks, if you like.
Oh, okay. So yeah,
that was conscious decision to, in part of the kit that we gave each of the producers for their location, was to have some sound recording elements so that we could build that sense of place into the sound design. And so we layered those up create, as you go to each park in post, you do, that's what you're hearing.
Yeah, we try and create a sense of place, as you say, a real sense of character for each park, because each park's got its own story to tell. We want each episode to feel very different from the next. You know, natural history needs to keep surprising audiences, and it's good that if you feel that every episode's got something different to say, and sound actually creates a huge part of that. Otherwise, in terms of pictures, though, you know, we obviously shot terabytes of material, as you might expect, and it all comes back and ends up in cutting rooms in Bristol, where we undertake a normal sort of edit process.
And did those puzzle pieces in the edit come together pretty seamlessly, maybe mapped to that original storyboard and script that you had outlined 3 years prior? Or were there some big challenges, like, we need to really change it up at this moment?
Well, you always want to look at it afresh and make sure it's the best it can be. And maybe your ideas 3 years ago weren't, you know, didn't stand the test of time. But it is amazing how often it does align and it does end up, and we end up, you know, achieving what we hope to. And it's almost like nature has read the script somehow. So I think that's great, because it means the next project you do, you can go into it with a degree of sort of faith that it might turn out okay. But if, you know, it's just a bit hair raising when you're out there and waiting to see if the animals are going to show up. But once you're back in the cutting room, really, it's you know, it becomes much more of a normal editing process, and it's all about shaping the films to tell, you know, hopefully a nicely balanced film. But the choices you make at the beginning around the characters and the places and the phenomena that you're going to tell, all those things inevitably play out in the final edit, and you can see very clearly, you know, when you've made the right choice and that it does flow well. So it's kind of all that thinking time is invaluable. Yeah.
And you do get some nice surprises, like the hornbill dwarf mongoose in the Savu film. We wanted to tell the story of how these two completely different species work together and have this mutual relationship. But what we weren't expecting was to capture them getting these giant land snails and then smashing them into the rocks to try and get them out, because that was the death. They just loved these snails. And at first, when we were filming them, we could hear this bizarre noise in the background, and the team were trying to figure out what that was. And yeah, they were launching giant land snails at rocks in order to get them out. So that was just a nice bonus on the story that we'd set out to achieve in the first place.
And actually, it was a tool use, an example of behavioral tool use that wasn't known to happen there with those species. So yeah, a new bit of behavior for science as well, which is always good.
That's right.
Occasionally, just by being out there, you do see things that people haven't seen before, because you're spending so much time out there. Like, we found a species of hammerhead worm in Ungerloh, and that was just really exciting to find and film a new species that doesn't have a scientific name, that no one's seen before, but does something cool. That was very exciting.
And also revolting.
deeply
icky.
Yeah, it is.
So what are the reactions or feelings that you hope that viewers of this film series take away when they get up off the couch and walk back into their lives?
Well, I hope that they realize that even if they never step foot into a national park themselves, what happens in them is so important to us all. It affects us all. And they provide services for us on every kind of level, from oxygen through to possible new medical discoveries that we still might uncover. But also that connection. I think a lot of us, when we're growing up, will have a moment where you went to the woods or a park and you suddenly get that sense of nature being powerful and emotional for us. I'd love to reconnect people back to that. And I think it's something that came out during the pandemic. People began to appreciate nature again a bit more, even the jaded ones amongst us. And I'd like to take that forward. And we're also doing an impact campaign around the series, so that it's worldforall.org. So that if anybody viewing wants to take it forward, then it gives them some guidance on the sort of things they can do, which I think is important, you know, just not to create the momentum, but give it a place to go at the end of that.
Yeah. A place for interested viewers to find out how they can make a meaningful difference to support wilderness everywhere. And that, for me, that's the take home, is it's about our relationship to wilderness and wilderness being really important. You know, these are not empty spaces that are meaningless, and they're actually doing vital functions for us that keep our planet healthy, that keep ourselves healthy, and that we need them. We need wild spaces, and we should also probably get out and enjoy them, because they're fantastic and they're inspiring and they're wondrous, and they support us in so many ways, but they need our help too. So that's for the wildforall.org digital campaign comes in.
And for listeners out there, I will put the link to Wild for All and that campaign in the show notes, as well as the link to the Netflix show. But it's probably pretty easy to find on Netflix, which is one of the beauties about Netflix. But before we go, I like to ask all my guests if they have one last piece of advice that they'd like to leave people with in terms of advice on becoming a better documentary storyteller. If you had to offer one last piece of advice, whether it could be around natural history or just documentary storytelling in general, what would be one piece of advice that you'd leave us with today?
I'd say go with your heart, in your gut. When you start to think about a story, if you can't get it out of your head, then you're doing the right thing. If you're constantly wrestling with how do I make this stand out, then you haven't nailed it yet. That would be my, you know, when you go with instinct.
I think for me, it's all about the emotional journey. It's keeping the audience forefront in your mind and thinking about the emotional journey you'd like them to go on. And I think documentaries can elicit many emotions in viewers. And it's not just about creating awe and wonder in natural history, is about a whole range of emotions. They should be, I feel, as emotionally rewarding as any drama, and that's what we should try and strive for.
Amazing advice. Well, James, Sophie, thank you so much for joining the show today, and best of luck as you roll this out to the world.
Great to meet you.
Thank you very much.
That's it for episode 51 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Thank you so much for listening on the podcast players or watching on the Austin Meyer Films YouTube channel. I hope this conversation brought you some value and helped deepen your understanding of the natural history genre of documentary filmmaking and of this series in particular. As of April 13th, 2022, our Great National Parks is streaming on Netflix, so head on over to check it out if you haven't. And if you want to see the impact campaign tied to the series or get involved in any way, go to wildforall.org. Wild for All is on a mission to encourage more people to experience the wonders of nature and to take steps to protect the world's wildlife and wild spaces. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a rating and review. It just takes about 10 seconds and it really helps the visibility of the show. Or share the episode with a friend who also makes or enjoys documentaries. I'm at Austin Meyer Films on Instagram. If you have a question for the show or a guest you'd like to hear from, please let me know. And with that, I'll see you on the next episode. Until then, go out and tell some stories.